Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. This past summer was the hottest on record for the Northern Hemisphere. We also saw tornadoes touch down on the Cape in July and two significant wind events so far this fall, not to mention a number of coastal flooding events. This is the new normal as we feel the impacts of a warming climate. Today we focus on our home landscapes, how we can make our yards, gardens, and trees more resilient to extremes in weather. Joining us is Russell Norton, Agriculture and Horticultural Extension Educator with the Cape Cod Cooperative Extension. Good morning.
Thank you.
And Kristen Andres, she's Director of Education and Outreach at the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Kristen, can you give us a sense of the kinds of extremes in temperature and rainfall we should expect to see as our climate is changing?
Well, I think we've already been experiencing some of these more intense rainstorms. I know in the last couple of years we've seen multiple inches in an hour, which has just been kind of unheard of. In our own personal experiences, and we know of areas that have been flooded in our roadways and other neighborhoods that we haven't necessarily seen. Been predicted to be more intense storms. That's kind of what's in our future, as well as heat waves and drought. In 2016, we saw a full summer of no rain here on the Cape, pretty much the Northeast was stricken with that drought.
Yeah. Russ, we've always been susceptible to wind events in this region, but it seems as though they're coming more frequently and more ferociously than before. So in addition to the tornadoes we had this summer, there were hurricane-force wind gusts recorded this fall during weather events. What kind of damage do these winds cause to trees across our region?
Can be pretty extensive. I think the most recent storm, we saw a tremendous amount of tree damage, whether it's branches breaking or whole trees failing. So it can be quite extensive depending on a lot of factors.
Yeah, which way it's coming.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether there's leaves and all that.
Yes.
So how do these cycles of drought and then downpour coupled with wind events impact the root systems of our native tree species like, you know, oaks and scrub pine? Does our sandy soil also make them more susceptible to kind of toppling over when we have
specifically with the toppling over question, kind of the pushing over of trees, that is actually probably less in sandy soils than clay soils or soils with a high water table or compacted soils where they would be more susceptible to being pushed over by winds. Other major factors in the pushing over events from high winds would be damage to the root system. So whether that's invasion from insect pests or fungal organisms or even construction damage, which oftentimes we remove portions of root systems when we do excavation and things like that. And those are the things that really do predispose trees to being pushed over in windstorms.
And sometimes you might not even notice it, right? I mean, you're not really realizing what's happening in those roots.
Yeah.
So, Kristen, gardening is a passion for many people in our region, and we love our hydrangeas and roses and perennial gardens. But these extremes in weather are going to make home gardening even more challenging. So as we assess the resiliency of our gardens and yards, what should we be considering?
Well, at the Association to Preserve Cape Cod, we have a native plant initiative, and we really encourage people to incorporate more native plant species into their yards. Our native plants have adapted to our soils and do well in poor soils in general. Many of them do, and can deal with the extremes of drought. They have deep roots and can do well in these more drought conditions, whereas something like a hydrangea, they're pretty much water hogs.
Mm-hmm.
They like a lot of water to look good all year round or all summer. So native plants, I think, are really kind of the keystone to a good, sustainable, and resilient landscape.
Yeah, and I think there definitely has been this trend towards, bringing more native plants to gardens. And I think, you know, obviously they have specific growing requirements as well. But what's your advice for finding these plants, and is there a list somewhere people can look at?
There's lots of great resource materials out there and websites. Many of them offer, there's Lady Bird Johnson's Wildlife Center has an online list for New England plants with all the information about each species and what kind of habit they need, what kind of soil, shade or sun, and that sort of thing. Polly Hill Arboretum has a plant sourcing. You can plug in what your conditions are and it'll give you what a good native species is.
I said Polly Hill, that's a great resource because I know I've gone over there a couple times to their plant sale, and And it may not have been originally native to here, some of the things they have, but they have some really interesting plants that grow well as if they were native here, right?
Right. It's a really interesting arboretum, and everybody should go there. And Tim Boland, since he's been executive director, has really worked on a Martha's Vineyard ecotype native plant. So they've been growing a lot of plants from seed, which was Polly's. That was what she did with the plants that she grew for her arboretum, was by seed. And so it is a great place to go and buy native plants. And yeah, they'll do well in Martha's Vineyard, and they'll do well here on Cape Cod.
Yeah, another list, I don't know off the top of my head, Audubon has a list of plants that are bird friendly. So you kind of figure out which native plants are also attractive to the birds, and you kind of say, you know, let's say killing two birds with one stone, but you know what I mean. So Russ, after major wind events, people often look at the trees and see them as hazards. What should we keep in mind before we immediately start to remove trees from our landscape as a precautionary measure?
I think there's two really big things that people should be aware of. One is a risk. What causes risk with a hazardous tree? And that's really whether there's the potential for bodily injury or personal property damage. And so plenty of trees aren't going to cause either of those. And so there's really no need to remove those trees that don't cause and have any potential for risk. The other big factor is that trees do a lot of benefits for us. So not only do they increase our property values, but they can reduce heating costs from protecting from heat loss from wind. They can also reduce our cooling costs by providing shade during the summer. They give us oxygen, which we breathe, and capture carbon dioxide in the process. And then, you know, lastly, they provide a tremendous amount of food and wildlife habitat. So the benefits are definitely outweigh a lot of things. So you really got to be careful about that.
So as you're looking around, and I could see maybe the trees that are closest to the house that look like they could come down, you remove that. And maybe as you're thinking to replace them, right? I mean, when we remove trees, we should maybe think about putting something in its place. So maybe it's a dwarf tree. So what are your thoughts on, as we're kind of going through here, what are some good ideas of things to look at that would be good to plant here?
So, you know, it's not that simple.
No? I made it too simple.
The rule of thumb that we generally use for making planting decisions is kind of the term right plant for the right place, which is basically the idea of doing an assessment of the site to determine all the factors that would help you select a tree. So what type of soils you have, what type of wind exposure, sunlight exposure, all those factors go and kind of narrow your selection.
And how do you do that? I have a tree. I take out this this big giant oak that if it fell would smash my house, and maybe it's, you know, 15 feet from the house and it's a big oak tree.
Yeah, so understanding the site selection piece is just going and making notes, like, is it full sun? Is it partial shade? Is it shade? What type of soils do you have? Are they sandy soils? Are they clay soils? What's the pH of the soil? How much space does the tree actually have in its maturity, which is one that we often don't take into consideration.
Oh, yeah, I made that mistake. I've got a row of Leyland cypress in the back that, boy, I wish I never planted.
Yeah, it's a 100-foot tree.
and I'm trying to keep it not 100 feet. Yeah, so I have a feeling we're going to have to replace those.
Yeah.
All right, Kristen, explain to us what a rain garden is and how it works.
Oh, sure. A rain garden is really just a garden that's in a depression that captures rainwater, usually from a roof. We have a rain garden at APCC's office, which captures water that comes down the gutter downspout and is directed into this rain garden. And then the rain garden's planted with deep-rooted native plants. So we have things like Joe Pye weed and boneset and liatris, winterberry, and it's pretty much a full sun rain garden. So those are the species we put in there. You can also have a rain garden that's in the shade that might take ferns and other things. But the reason for a rain garden is to slow the water down and let it slowly absorb into the soils.
Yeah. So if we have an area that tends to pool with the rainwater in our yards, and we don't want to plant a rain garden per se, are there trees or other woody plants that we could put there that might survive that would, you know, maybe need more water?
Sure. Yeah, any of our willows, tupelo, there are lots of plants. Winterberry is one of them, too, that grows along wetland edges. There are lots of plants that would like to take up that moisture. And, in fact, years ago, they used to plant willow to dry up wetlands before we understood how valuable
how
our
it works.
Are.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, with the rain garden, it sounds like you have a really pretty rain garden there with some of the plants that you were just describing. So, when we have like a summer like 2016 where we don't have a lot of water, how does that impact the rain garden?
Sure. A rain garden's not without maintenance, or certainly you need to
Nothing
establish.
Nothing is without maintenance.
Exactly. I mean, it's still a garden, so before it gets fully established, plants may need to be watered and weeded, you know, at least keeping an eye and knowing, you know, just what plants you want in there are the ones that are there. But the idea is that they would all then fill in, and they really help each other with moisture retention. And so after that first year of establishment, we've had very good success in really letting it be.
Right. So I don't know if this is a question for Kristen or Russ, but how do trees, especially when they are leafed out, help mitigate the impacts of heavy rainfall?
One thing is they actually break up the droplets from hitting soil, which can actually cause erosion and things like that. So just a physical barrier from the water directly hitting the ground is one way that it impacts.
Yeah. I would imagine, too, it's kind of as those little droplets are falling down. I think gardeners have been noticing for many years now how we used to have those nice, soft, light rains, you know, that were great for the gardens. And then we get those heavy rains, so a lot of the water runs off, except for maybe the trees, the leaves that collect that. It kind of imitates that soft rain, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to ask a question or have a comment for us this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Russ, what about shallow-rooted versus more deeply-rooted things? Like, you know, rhododendrons are pretty shallow-rooted. What do we need to think about when we're thinking about how deep the roots go?
So one of the misconceptions often of trees and plants is that they have deep root systems, and actually almost all trees and shrubs have very shallow root systems, with something like 90% of their roots being in the top foot of soil. So it's kind of universal. Where we have sandy soils and oxygen can get deeper in the soil because of the coarse pore spaces, we actually have some species that are a little bit deeper rooting, like pitch pine and some of our oak species, which can tap into deeper mm-hmm. water reserves in the soil.
Yeah. I guess that's why those pitch pines hang around for so
long. That's right. Yeah, they're well adapted to our area.
Yeah, they're so, some of them are pretty big, yeah. We don't tend to get a lot of snow on the Cape, but when we do, it's often heavy and wet. And this is particularly hard on evergreens, pines, and cedars. So Russ, as we plant and maintain trees, should we also be thinking about the impacts of snow?
Yeah, not only snow, but what causes more damage to trees is usually ice storms. So ice storms have a huge potential to cause a lot of damage. And as you mentioned, some of the evergreens are kind of susceptible, especially larger white pines and pitch pines. But the more conical-shaped evergreens, so think of spruces and firs and even some cedars, actually have nearly ideal shapes for being able to handle such damage. Yeah. It's when we manipulate those shapes and turn them into like bookshelves and things like that, you know, the squares and the meatballs that we see in the landscape, those are more likely to be damaged because snow can really pile up on the tops of them.
And then you always want to go out, kind of shake them off after the snowstorm see how many broken branches that you have. Kristen, rain barrels are another way to help capture stormwater. Tell us how they work.
Sure. A rain barrel is kind of an old-fashioned way to capture roof runoff. If you've got gutters to a downspout, you can put a rain barrel under that. We have a program every year where we sell rain barrels, and you can certainly buy them online, and some of the stores have them. They may be, in our case, we sell their repurposed food barrels, and they capture water. They're just put underneath the downspout, and the water goes into the screened hole at the top of the barrel, and then there's a spigot at the bottom where you'd fill your watering can or put a hose to it. And they're gravity-fed, so if your rain barrel can be upgrade from your garden, it's a wonderful way to water your vegetable garden. If it's not, you can get a little submersible pump and get it to where you want it to go. But carrying a watering can is good exercise.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about how to make our home landscapes, our yards, gardens, and trees more resilient to extremes in weather. With us is Russell Norton, Agriculture and Horticultural Extension Educator at Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, and Kristen Andres. She's the Director of Education and Outreach at the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Russ, as we assess the health of our trees and their vulnerability to wind damage, what are the things that we're looking for? I'm going to think, you know, we all get attracted sometimes by, you know, the crepe myrtle and the figs and things that are kind of, yeah, you might have them for a couple of years, but we're sort of on that border of you know, they're not really native to this area. So what are we looking at?
As far as assessing health?
Yeah, assessing like you know, what would be more vulnerable in these kinds of weather extremes that we see?
Yeah, so you can go a couple different ways with this, but one thing is looking at the overall ability for it to handle the conditions that we have. So most of the Cape is in USDA Hardiness Zone 7, a little bit in 6B, but making sure that the trees are actually hardy to those zones. What we expect with climate change is, even though we are going to see generally warmer conditions, that there are going to be more extreme events as well. So it's important that we don't start choosing plants that are really not adapted to the coldness of our area. So that's one thing. Other characteristics might be what we're looking in for a tree. You know, trees that have good structure. So some trees have better overall shape mm-hmm. than others. So trees that generally have a main central leader, a conical shape, and then fairly small branching compared to the trunk are actually the stronger structures for trees. Mm.
So are there some trees that are more resilient to strong winds than others?
There definitely are. There's been a fair amount of research out of the University of Florida. They've had, as you know, many hurricanes, and they've been able to take a lot of data. So there are, but I would suggest always going back to that right plant for mm-hmm. the right place instead of making the choice first with wind resistance, mm-hmm. but going through the whole steps, because a healthy tree is going to be your best option.
So you want a healthy tree, and when you say right place, you mentioned this before, right plant for the right place. So we're looking at how much space it has,
right?
How much sun, as you said, the soil.
The
so
hardiness,
what we're looking,
yeah,
what we're looking for then is we're trying to match a plant or a tree to the space we have, so that we're not going to have to do a lot of you know, help to keep this thing
yep.
alive.
And it will be better adapted to that space as well. And so, being better adapted means that it will be healthier, and then it won't be predisposed to a lot of the issues that might come up with an unhealthy tree
right.
that are more susceptible to wind damage.
What's the best time of year to have a tree work done? Is it winter or when trees are dormant? Is it spring? You know, I guess it depends on the tree, right?
So the dormant season, and generally I think of late winter, is the best time for almost anything. There's a tremendous amount of nuances within mm-hmm. timing, but you're safe if you're doing it during the dormant season, especially in the late winter, on any species.
Yeah. See, because if you start doing it now, you're going to have some trouble, because when you prune them, that's going to encourage growth, and it's starting to get cold.
It's probably too late to encourage growth at this point.
Is it?
But those wounds will probably heal slower, and so when you're creating that wound, you're also creating a place for decay organisms to get in, so that slower healing might actually lead to more predisposed yeah. to decay organisms.
So how do we determine when it's best to call in an arborist? And then if you think that you need an arborist, what are you looking for? How do you find a good one?
So the best way to find a good arborist is to look for a certified arborist. There's the Mass Certified Arborist Association and the International Society of Arboriculture. Both of their websites have great kind of find a arborist near you resources, so you can select one that services your area and also for the service that you're looking for, whether it's pruning or, say, a health assessment. Mm-hmm. So that's how I would do it, and I would always suggest for someone to probably have at least one person come out, but maybe as many as three if you're going to do a big job, to get quotes and make sure that everybody's on the same page.
Yeah. And you said a health assessment, so getting an arborist to come in and just, they can help you determine some of these things that you might not know yourself, right?
Yeah, exactly. So things like internal decay, which are one of the things that really predisposes trees to failures during storms, is something that is best assessed by a certified arborist.
Mm. Now, you know, we've had, as we mentioned, some of these, you know, last year, remember, we also had that where a lot of the trees, we had all that rain and then the wind. And I actually have one that's kind of close to the road that's leaning a little bit now. Is that something I should be thinking about? Like, is that thing going to fall on the road? Should I be taking it down?
A leaning tree is definitely a tree that you'd want to have an arborist look at to make sure there's no necessarily issues with the root system that might make it susceptible to...
It could have just moved in all that soft soil, but maybe not, right?
That's right, yeah.
Hard to tell. All right, Kristen, people who don't want to be bothered with a garden might think a lawn is a good option. Grass goes dormant when it gets hot and dry and typically springs back to life once we get rainfall. Are lawns a good option in resilient landscape?
Actually, lawns do take, particularly turf lawns, maybe not a Cape Cod lawn. Our traditional Cape Cod lawns here are really anything that's green. Mm-hmm. So it includes moss and all sorts of things. And definitely, if it's a Cape Cod lawn, you don't mow that in the summer. It goes dormant and you forget about it. But for folks that have, you know, come in and put in turf lawns, that's a huge energy suck, really. Mm-hmm. Takes a lot of, they're usually irrigated and they're putting chemicals on them and then obviously the mowing. So the rule of a good eco-friendly approach is to have a design where your lawn is more like a throw rug than wall-to-wall carpeting.
That's a good analogy. I like that. Yeah.
Not my analogy, someone else's, but it's so true. I think landscape design, a big turf lawn is so passe as far as, design goes.
I hear some people who want to get rid of the moss. I'm like, I love the moss. I'm like, I want that moss to spread. It feels good when you walk on it.
Right.
You know, you don't have to mow it. It's green. It's pretty.
Yeah, and if you like that low open area, just from a design standpoint, it can be... You know, you can have clover, you can have violets, things that are all going to be a little bit more resilient and also support resiliency in our pollinators and our beneficial insects to have that diversity in a lawn.
I have the violets, I have the clover. And, I know people try to get rid of that stuff, but I honestly think the clover is what keeps the rabbits out of the gardens I don't want them in. I have the rabbits in my yard. I should knock on whatever this is here. They have never jumped up into my vegetable beds because they seem to be perfectly happy with the clover.
I've heard the same thing, yes.
Yeah, so I'm not crazy. That is what's happening. All right, so stormwater runoff will become more of an issue with heavier downpours and rain events. In addition to rain barrels and water gardens, what are some changes we can make in our yards to lessen water runoff?
Sure. Well, one of them is reducing lawn, particularly if you're on a sloping lot. More native plants and having a diversity of plants helps break up the rainfall and allows it to soak into the soil more slowly than lawn. Sometimes lawn is very compacted and it causes sheet flow when it rains hard. There are also things we can do on our hardscape. If you need to have a driveway that's hardened and gravel and shell aren't going to do it for you, there are permeable applications that you can use as alternatives to asphalt. Asphalt conveys water and is going to make it run off somewhere away, and really a best management practice is to allow the water to soak in where it falls. So these permeable applications allow water to do that. Mm. Some are like, there's a percrete, which is a concrete that has open pores. We have porous pave at our office, which is recycled tires that has been bound, but allows
water to
soak.
Well, that sounds like it lasts a long time, right?
Yeah. And we like the fact that it recycled 300 tires for our handicap space.
Is it too late for people who already have these hard surfaces? Is this just for new projects, or is there something you can just probably, once you've already got your asphalt down, you're not going to be able to put something?
If you already have an asphalt driveway and you're and it is shedding water off onto the roadway, you could probably have it retrofitted with a trench drain or maybe just a portion of it is retrofitted with some other permeable application, like the concrete or porous pavers or things like that.
Let's talk to John, who's giving us a call from Pocasset. Hi, John. Oh, John's gone. All right. 866-999-4626. We have you for a few more minutes if you want to call in. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Kristen, tell us how the town of Chatham is addressing stormwater runoff.
I used to work for the town of Chatham, and the building inspector, and some towns may have certainly bylaws in place that look at water runoff from properties as part of their community's need to address the MS4 permit for stormwater. communities want to, again, try to encourage property owners to keep the water on the site and not contribute to the community stormwater on the roadways, which then is, you know, a lot of infrastructure and maintenance. We're really, again, from a water quality standpoint, we want the rainwater to soak in the ground where it falls. So trying to limit roadways, driveways that empty out onto roadways. And so when new construction occurs, building commissioners, and a lot of communities probably have it in their bylaw where they're looking at, you know, requiring a trench drain or requiring a permeable driveway or having the driveway, again, just designed in such a way that it doesn't shed stormwater off onto the roadway.
You both go around talking and trying to educate people on both of these topics that we're talking about. Have you found that there are more people kind of listening? You know, because education is always the toughest, no matter what it is. You know, people kind of get set in their ways, and to help them understand what's happening in the environment can be tough. What are you finding when you're out talking about storm runoff and rainfall?
Yeah, well, when stormwater is not something everybody pays attention to, unless they have a problem, maybe. But I think that people are interested. They maybe never thought about where the stormwater goes and the impacts that it has. And I think we're looking at a lot of different ways of thinking about things than we did traditionally, like stormwater, which we've the traditional view is to just was to just get rid of the water on the roadways and to dispose of it. And now we realize that our water is an incredible resource and we need to hold on to it, clean it, let it soak back into our aquifer. And so I think people are very, at least the audiences that show up, are very interested in what they can do better on their properties because they love Cape Cod, they love the environment, and it's a really empowering thing to know that what you do on your own property can make a difference.
And a big difference, right? Yeah. So what are you finding, Russ?
So I was kind of surprised when I first started doing presentations on storms and trees that there's a lot of interest, and the weather has kind of played right mm-hmm. into that as well. So what's happening and what's current is really promoting you know, an attentive audience with all the power outages and damage that we've seen over the last couple of years has really played right into this topic.
Yeah, with a changing climate, there's also the potential for new pests to appear. Are there any on your radar that might be a threat to our native tree species?
Yeah, so probably the most important forest threat for our area right now is southern pine beetle, which not so long ago was considered the northern extent of its range was in New Jersey, but since then it has been found doing damage on Long Island in New York and also in Connecticut. And it has the potential to cause damage here in southeastern Massachusetts with our extensive pitch pine stand. Mm-hmm. So that's one where we're really staying on top of, trying mm-hmm. to make sure that...
So you're watching where it goes.
Yeah, so we've trapped it in Massachusetts.
Oh, you have, okay.
It just hasn't been found actually affecting a tree yet, found in traps.
Yeah, so that's another reason people should be very careful about what kind of wood they bring over from elsewhere, right? Or plants that they're bringing from somewhere else.
Yeah, so, you know, we generally don't encourage people to move firewood and things like that because of the potential to move pests around.
Right. Russ and Kristen will be giving workshops about landscaping for resiliency at the Wacoit Bay National Estuarian Research Reserve. Russ's talk, All About Trees, is this Thursday, and Kristen's talk is about rainwater and runoff next Thursday, November 14th. We'll post a link with more information about the workshop series at our website, capeandislands.org. Russell Norton, Agriculture and Horticultural Extension Educator, Cape Cod Cooperative Extension. Kristen Andres, Director of Education and Outreach at the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. Thank you both for coming in today.